Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest display of disrespect towards the mayor of New York from members of the NYPD at the funeral of a police officer killed in the line of duty. Joe Dominic, an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Law, joins us to discuss the man caught in the middle between an embattled mayor and angry rank-and-file NYPD Commissioner William Bratton, who was profiled in Joe Dominic's new book, Blue, The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD, and who had asked his officers to show respect for Mayor de Blasio at Sunday's funeral of the fallen officer Wen-Jian Liu. Then we'll look into the top priority of the new Republican Congress, which is to change the way how the government measures the impacts of tax cuts on federal revenues, thus allowing Republican lawmakers to reward their wealthy backers with tax cuts whose real impact on the federal deficit will be shielded. The author of We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California and a former chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, joins us to discuss the hypocrisy of the deficit hawks and their apparent intention to bankrupt the government in order to destroy social programs, as well as his article in the New York Times, A Republican Ruse to Make Tax Cuts Look Good. Then finally, we'll examine the reasons behind the rout of the multinational force which fled from a Nigerian army base on the border with Chad and abandoned the civilian residents of the town of Baga in the face of an attack from Boko Haram. Anide Ekure, the executive director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, joins us to discuss the inability of the government of Goodluck Jonathan to address the growing threat from Boko Haram and the Nigerian military's apparent lack of morale and motivation. And joining us now is Joe Dominic, an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and associate director of the Center on Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Law. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, the LAPD Century of War in the City of Dreams, which won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Nonfiction Book, and Cruel Justice, Three Strikes, and the Politics of Crime in America's Golden State. His latest book is Blue, The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Dominic.
Ian, always a pleasure to be with you.
And Joe, you've done this, this in effect a third book on the LAPD, but a big part of your book is your new book is profiling William Bratton, who was led the LAPD, and I take it he led it from ruin to redemption, and now he's headed up the NYPD, and he is the man caught in the middle. So, what's your sense of how he's going to navigate his way through this, given that at the funeral today of the slain police officer, hundreds of NYPD officers turned their backs when Bill de Blasio came on the jumbo screen in front of the funeral house?
Well, I think if we look at Bratton and his performance as NYPD commissioner in 2014, I think we'll get some hints about how he's done and how he will do. In answer to your reference about the cops turning their back on de Blasio today, I think that we need to look at that as Bratton and de Blasio's biggest failure in a year otherwise filled with triumph in New York in terms of police reform. And I think that their failure was based probably on two things. One of them being relatively little of the kind of intense vituperativeness that has been directed at de Blasio was directed at Bratton, and I think that he kind of failed to pick up on how deep was the wellspring of the anger of the unions and the rank and file towards de Blasio. And I think that de Blasio was, you know, simply the new guy on the block, wanting to do new things, and was new big things, and was uh, and And there was a problem, and the problem was that he didn't realize, having not been part of that kind of a breeze, that it was going to blow so strongly at him. And that's the biggest failure among the triumphs, as I said.
But how can the mayor operate with a hostile police force? They've already shown disrespect in much greater numbers at the earlier funeral of the other officer who was slain, and the reason that this funeral of Wen Zhenlu was delayed was because members of the of his extended family from China had to come over here for the funeral. But in the interim between these two funerals, the police apparently have slowed down. They're not giving tickets. They're having a kind of a collective blue flu type of protest. So how does Bratton deal with that? I mean, I thought the police were an organization based on discipline.
Well, first of all, one of the things that needs to be understood is that this is an outrage, an arrogance that's developed ever since 9/11, or with the NYPD under Ray Kelly. This feeling that they're somehow on a, this is the old story with the LAPD too. Ian, the feeling that they're somehow unaccountable and above criticism and above civilian control. So how does Bratton and de Blasio deal with that? I think the way that they're doing it right now, they're taking it, they're absorbing it. Bratton, they're standing as one. Bratton has been stalwart in his defense of de Blasio, and I believe that this will die down. You know, one of the reasons that the unions, which are always led by nasty guys, you know, who are petulant and angry and really kind of uncooperative and constantly fighting with mayors. This isn't a new thing. Constantly fighting with mayors and police chiefs and police commissioners. I think that will start to end. The Patrolmen's Benevolent Association is currently without a contract, has been without one since 2010, and those guys, the 25,000 guys that are on patrol, are really underpaid. And you know, when you're a patrolman in New York City in that intense atmosphere, and you're over 30 years old, the job actually sucks. You know, so they're disgruntled to begin with. I also question just how deeply this resentment goes throughout the breadth of the NYPD. The NYPD is no longer Irish and Italian guys, living in Staten Island and upstate New York and out on Long Island. Who have contempt for the city and the people of the city.
And who are Republican, right, by and large.
And who are by conservative, deeply Republican, and willfully ignorant. I hate to say all of these things, but they need to be said. But what you got now is a department that remains 50% white, but the other 50% are from all different races and sexual orientations, people who grew up as outsiders and, you know, may be sympathetic to the kind of community policing Bratton is proposing to change the culture of the NYPD as he did here in Los Angeles. So I think that it looks dire, but a lot of this stuff going on with the unions is because contracts haven't been settled, and Bloomberg left, I think, 1,500 contracts, municipal contracts that weren't settled. The Blasio's settled a lot of them, and I think you can view what Pat Lynch, the head of the Patrolmen Association, told the the patrol. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I have a dry mouth here.
Sure, no, he's the head of the largest police union, Patrick Lynch, and he's the guy that lashed out at de Blasio saying there was blood on his hands.
Precisely. You know, I think you can look at that as a negotiating tactic, as much as outrage and the perpetual anger of these union guys. So I think Bratton is extraordinarily skillful. You notice that little of this criticism has been directed at him, although, as I mentioned earlier, he stood as one with de Blasio and is essentially successfully last year undone one of his premier innovations of the 1990s in New York, stop and frisk. Stop and frisks have gone down 79% this year, and crime has continued its drop in New York. So that's an amazing achievement. Ray Kelly, in his last year in office under great pressure, reduced stop and frisk by 35%, and crime dropped. And this year, Bratton reduced it by another 79%, and crime still dropped. So, that's the reality of the situation. Now, Bratton's going to have a far tougher job in changing the culture of the NYPD, because most of those guys don't want to do the hard work of community policing, don't understand it, think that Bratton and de Blasio are trying to fix something that's not broken.
And Bill Bratton did, the New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton, did write a memo urging his officers to refrain from any acts of disrespect. And in the memo, he said, a hero's funeral is about grieving, not grievance. And yet hundreds of police officers did turn their backs on de Blasio's image on the big jumbo screen in front of the funeral today for the slain police officer, Wenjen Liu. So clearly, Bratton still has got work to be done. What's your sense then of the lessons learned from the LAPD? What did he do to fix the LAPD? Which, of course, is the subtitle of your book, "The Ruin and Redemption of the LAPD."
Well, what Bratton did was to change the culture of the LAPD. Move it far more into a community policing model, which means doing the hard work of building relations within a community, and establishing trust and legitimacy within that community. Now, he did that really well, and at the time, the current chief, Charlie Beck, was bureau chief of South Bureau, and so he's continued that pretty well, and I think that this is Bratton's task, and he's a change agent. He's a hired gun. He's moved from police department to police department, from a chief of the New York City Transit Police to chief of the Boston PD, the NYPD, and the LAPD. So he knows bureaucracies. He knows how to deal with them. He knows how to put the right people in place. This is a crisis. But Bratton came into that job the way he's gone into every job, highly well prepared and understanding what the task was. And who a lot of the key players are. He's really matured remarkably in terms of his political skills, and he's been right on the money throughout this thing, with the very big exception of not recognizing the death of resentment. But you know, Ian, he has got to succeed. De Blasio has got to succeed. It's a mistake to look at this as just a New York problem. We see from Ferguson and from all the other you know, holy cow murders by police officers around the country, that that things have to change. And that experiment is going on in New York, and you know, on the big stage. So you know, if you want to be on the right side of history, you got to root for Bratton and de Blasio, because this is a pivotal time. It's the biggest police crisis we've seen since the early '90s, when crime in a lot of cities was out of control.
So now
it's a human rights issue.
But my understanding that there's a subtext to a lot of the problems that the police are having with their communities, and that is that since the recession, cities have had tremendous falling short in their revenues, and they've resorted to increasing the number of parking tickets and citations to build city revenues. And this came up during Ferguson. There was a tremendous amount of resentment that the local community had towards their police forces because they simply were gouging them with unfair tickets, which many people couldn't pay, and they double and triple and as you don't pay them. But they are also a source of revenue. So there you have a kind of built-in conflict, don't you? The police are raising revenues, and the mayor needs the revenues to run the city, and this is a source of friction with the community.
Well, you know, that's right. And that falls under the rubric of another Bratton innovation, which is quality of life policing, or broken windows policing, which is a philosophy that says you arrest people and you ticket people for doing small things, so that they don't grow into big things, into big crimes. And that's something that this is another problem Bratton has, that he's going to have to find a way to modify broken windows policing within community policing, because if you're just constantly giving people, you know, stop and frisk resulted in constant confrontations between people being stopped and the police, and the same holds for broken windows policing. If you're constantly being ticketed or arrested for the most minor of crimes, and you're a poor person in New York City, this is a big problem for you, that and for police community relations that Bratton's going to have to address.
And of course, the strangulation to death of Eric Garner, who was selling untaxed cigarettes on a street corner in New York, which led to much of the problems that we have today. That's an example of what you're saying. But just in closing, the LAPD is what, about 8,000 officers? You said NYPD is 24,000.
No, the LAPD is 10,000 officers.
Oh, they've gone up from eight.
The NYPD is 35,000 officers, about 25,000 of which are patrol officers.
So presumably, that if he could fix, Bratton could fix the LAPD, he's got a lot more people to work with there in New York, hasn't he? Over double the number.
Yeah, it was easier for Bratton to reform the LAPD than it's going to be for him to reform the NYPD. By the time Bratton got to L.A., you know, it had been 10 years of trying to bring the department under control. The department was under a tough federal consent decree, overseen by a tough federal judge. And, you know, a lot of reforms had been put in place where you could get rid of the chief of police, for example. And then Bratton brought in his experience and managed to do it. With the NYPD, crime has gone down every year, Ian, for the past 20 years in New York. And a lot of people don't think the department is fixed. That is, a lot of middle-class white people. But for black people and for black and brown young men in New York, The department is just another problem among a multitude of problems that they have to face every day.
Well, John,
it's going to be much harder because the department doesn't feel that it needs to be fixed, and I think that's part of what you're seeing when these officers are turning their back at these funerals.
Well, Joe Dominic, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Joe Dominic, who's an award-winning investigative journalist, author, and the associate director of the Center for Media, Crime, and Justice at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about the new Republican ruse to disguise the impact of tax cuts on government revenue.
Are you really for peace?
Outside the patient millions, put them into power. Expect a little more back for their taxes. Like school books, bedding, hospitals, and peace in our bloody time. All they get is old men grinding.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. Before joining USC Law, he served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, A Republican Ruse to Make Tax Cuts Look Good. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And this top priority of the Republicans as they take control of Congress appears to be, as you've pointed out in your op-ed in the New York Times, a way to disguise the impact of tax cuts on government revenues. And so let me begin with my cynical interpretation, which is that these Republican lawmakers are rewarding the wealthy backers and at the same time shielding the impact. And these are the very people who are the big deficit hawks. So this seems to me to be the, rampant hypocrisy.
Well, there is a logical disconnect at work, that's for sure. I think it's important, frankly, not to underestimate the importance of ideology, of a peculiar kind of ideology that has dominated our fiscal politics for the last two or three decades now, which is the idea that there's something inherently evil about taxation, that it is fundamentally taking from those who've worked hard, and it is a fundamentally immoral act. None of that is true. Taxes are what define a country. That's the difference between a country and a country club, is that we assert the power to tax over our own citizens. And that money is in turn put to good use in investments and in insurance programs that benefit all of us. But the ideology that tax cuts are inherently virtuous as well as lead to enormous economic growth, that ideology really seems to dominate an awful lot of thinking on the Republican side of the aisle.
But surely you have a test case for this ideology proving it so incredibly wrong, and that's in the state of Kansas, where Governor Brownback, former senator, has enacted this ideological agenda, and the state's going broke.
Well, exactly. It is a fundamentally intellectually dishonest enterprise. It takes a couple of obvious points, which are true in great moderation, which is people change their behavior in response to taxes. People will presumably work harder in a low-tax environment than in a high-tax environment, and extrapolates out from that a series of conclusions that just aren't supported by the facts. The actual fact is that the United States of America is the lowest taxed country among all the major economies in the world as a percentage of its national income, as a percentage of GDP. We're the lowest taxed country. You know, the bankers of Zug, Switzerland, you know, would die to live in a tax environment as attractive as ours.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart. He's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. He previously served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, a Republican ruse to make tax cuts look good. So just describe to us, Ed, exactly how the Republican Congress is trying to enact this change that would disguise the impact of tax cuts on government revenues.
Right. Well, you know, it'll come as a surprise to many listeners, but the government actually does try to keep track of how it's doing financially through a budget. It prepares 10-year forward projections. And any time that a tax law change is proposed, the nonpartisan staff at my old outfit, the Joint Committee on Taxation, working with the Congressional Budget Office, is charged with answering the question, what will this proposed change in tax law do to tax revenues over the next 10 years compared to just keeping current law? And in doing that exercise, the scorekeepers, as they're known, the scorekeepers take into account the behavioral consequences of taxation. They take into account the example in the op-ed, a nice simple one. If you raise the excise tax on cigarettes, some people who today are smokers will quit because the cigarettes have become more expensive. Other non-smokers will never take it up because they're so expensive. And all of those kinds of behavioral impacts are taken into account in the very sophisticated models that are employed to answer the question, what will this proposed change do to future tax revenues? What the Republican agenda is to add another layer to that, to measure indirect feedback effects that today are not measured. Today, the scorekeepers keep the national income of the United States a constant. They don't assume that a change in tax law is going to lead to greater or lesser GDP in either direction. And that's probably not strictly correct. If you in fact were omniscient and in fact you had a very large tax bill, it would affect national income to some extent, some modest extent. But no one is omniscient, and the models that exist to try to capture those indirect feedback effects have a lot of issues associated with them. Nonetheless, the Republican agenda that is being pushed very hard is going to be to mandate the use of these models that incorporate these indirect feedback effects in order to claim that a tax cut will raise substantial national income, additional national income, which in turn will lead to additional tax revenues. Now, at the moment, only the most extreme would go all the way to say that that means that tax cuts pay for themselves, and that's long since been disproved. That's, you know, patently false. But it can amount to hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of difference over the course of a decade. The Republican methodology would say we can afford to cut taxes and have a larger deficit, because that larger deficit will never come to pass because the economy will grow so much faster as a result of our tax cut.
Well, we've been told for the longest time that tax cuts free up the entrepreneurial spirit of American businesses and entrepreneurs, and we're all rewarded by that. But it's simply not true. This has led to the growing income disparity, has it not? I mean, that seems
It has. It has. You know, we don't we're surrounded by both by our own personal experiences and by data demonstrating that starting, as I said before, starting from a base where the United States is the lowest taxed country among all the major economies in the world, tax cuts are not what's needed to grow this economy. As my book, I think my book does a pretty darn good job of demonstrating, what we really need is a lot more in the way of investments and insurance programs, investments made by the public sector to benefit all of us. Those are the investments that aren't getting made today. There's no major company in the United States that is starved of capital. There's no entrepreneur with the next great app who can't raise venture capital money at the snap of his fingers. So we're not a country that is impeding economic growth in any significant way by our tax policies. They're stupid in some respects. They need reform. But the problem is not that the tax burden is too high as a whole. Interest rates are at historic lows, notwithstanding that the economy is booming for the most affluent. So no matter how you look at things, the problem with the American economy today is the problem of the vast majority of Americans not participating in growth, not the lack of growth.
And we all, just to support what you just said, Edward Kleinblatt, and which you've made clear in your new book, We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, corporate America is just awash with money. There's just their treasuries are overflowing with money. They're parking it abroad. They don't know what to do with all the money.
Yeah,
and also, you know, tax cuts, the interest rates being as low as they are, this would be a perfect opportunity for America to invest in its crumbling infrastructure. This is one of the great historic opportunities that's being missed.
Exactly right. When American firms today have over $1 trillion essentially in cash parked overseas, which is an extraordinary sum of money even by national standards. You know, $1 trillion actually moves needles in economic metrics. There is no problem of access to capital in the private sector. But as you say, infrastructure in the public sector is being starved. And the fact is, there are large financial returns to public investment in infrastructure in the old-fashioned return on money type measure of financial returns. And there are larger social returns because construction jobs of that sort create good quality jobs and a pathway, a secure pathway to the middle class for lots of Americans who are not going to be software engineers. And that's one of the big themes of this book. So the investments we're not making are the investments in the public sector. And those are the investments that are going to be cut. And what's particularly frustrating about the models that the Republicans want to use to justify tax cuts is that buried deep, deep, deep inside the models, always unstated, never acknowledged explicitly, is the assumption that all government spending is wasted money, that government never makes a useful investment. And that's just false. You know, government makes lots of useful investments. Government insurance programs increase the welfare, the happiness of the American people. These models essentially treat government spending as all wasted money. And these models also, in order to make them compute, assume also deep in the model, also unstated, that tax cuts will be combined with spending cuts of this useless spending, and it's those spending cuts that actually drive the model's returns. So there are these deep, unstated assumptions that are untrue and that would, in fact, elicit a completely different response among the electorate if you were told, yay, you're going to get a tax cut, and, oh, by the way, we're going to slash Social Security as well. That would be a very different conversation, but that second part is never stated.
Well, but of course, a lot of these Republican ideologues don't mind government spending when it comes to military spending on military contractors and on agribusiness and other programs that are essentially, you know, a form of right-wing welfare, if you will. What I was astounded by was the compromise bill that came out just before this last Congress ended, which a lot of Democrats were outraged by, and Nancy Pelosi, in fact, rebelled against the White House. But in that bill, the Republicans are already tipping their hand about what they're going to be doing now that they can control the Congress, and that is that they cut funds for the IRS and for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. So, you know, what's the logic between cutting funds for the IRS, which is already underfunded? I mean, you know, what's the I don't understand the ideology, but can't logic at some point prevail that, you know, we might as well have a efficient way to collect money fairly? I mean, as opposed to basically crippling the agency that's supposed to – it's the only part of the government that actually makes any money. I don't know why people hate it so much.
You know, you're absolutely right. The IRS has a tremendous return on its spending, in the sense of by enforcing the existing tax rules, we make the system fairer. We collect more money. We do it in a way that's fair to everybody. So the Americans, you know, are famous for their extremely highly developed sense of fairness. And if you actually think about that for a while, what you'd want is a reasonably robust Internal Revenue Service that ensures that the tax laws as they exist are being applied fairly. Second, you would want a world in which we were not conducting, you know, ersatz, you know, Soviet-style five-year plans by subsidizing this or that big business in the form of subsidies from the federal government that we just hide inside the tax system, that we bake into the tax rules in order to grant subsidies that are less visible than writing out checks to agribusiness or whatever in your example. And finally, military. Well, look, the United States has by far the most outsized military in the world, however measured relative to population or any other measure. My book takes the view that I don't know whether that's good or bad. All I know for sure is that if you want to be the new Sparta, you need to pay for it. You need to collect tax revenue sufficient to fund the military that you actually want. You can't have it both ways and say that the only purpose of a government is to project military power while its own citizens lead lives materially worse than they would be with a more sensible approach to government. And so what's really needed is by the electorate. The electorate today is not engaged.
Well, just in closing, Ed Kleinbart, if the Republicans, this is apparently their top priority, to change the way that tax cuts impact the federal deficit and the federal budget and government revenues by disguising them through this new methodology that they want to enact, what's going to stop them, given that they have an increased majority in the House, they now run the Senate? By the way, extraordinary statistic I just read, that the 46 U.S. senators on the Democratic side compared to what the 56, I think, on the Republican side, the Democrats, the minority of the Democrats in the Senate got 20 million more votes than the majority Republicans. So the whole system seems whacked out. But just in terms of checks and balances, is this something that Obama can veto?
No. No, these are internal scorekeeping rules that Congress adopts as rules to govern its own processes. So the House will do this. The House has already published draft rules to require so-called dynamic scoring or macroeconomic scoring without any of these details, without which of the dozens of different models they're going to employ, which assumptions they're going to use, none of those details. They'll obviously choose or demand the most optimistic ones because they want to show the biggest return to tax cuts. The Senate side's a little bit more complicated because of the arcane rules under which the Senate operates, and it depends on whether tax legislation comes forward through a so-called reconciliation process or not. The Senate always acts as a bit of a brake on the House, and that can be frustrating or great news, depending on whether your political party is in the minority or not. But in the end, there will be pressure internally within Congress to overplay this hand. And the only response is a response that has to come from the American people that says, no, let's get our house in order. Let's have a tax base that is sufficient to fund the public investment that we need, that is sufficient to fund the social insurance programs that give dignity and a path forward to give genuine equality of opportunity to people. And without that, without public engagement, then, you know, this kind of, you know, nonsense will continue unabated.
Well, Edward Kleinbart, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into why the Nigerian army fled and abandoned the citizens of a town in Nigeria to Boko Haram. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anidi Akure, who is the Executive Director of Africa Faith and Justice Network, a community of advocates for responsible U.S. relations with Africa. He's a member of the Order of Preachers in the Dominican province of St. Joseph the Worker in Nigeria and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria and the Democratic Republic of Congo and the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anidi Akure.
Thank you very much.
And what is the explanation for how Boko Haram was able to seize this town of Baga on the border with Chad and a big military base that was manned by a multinational task force of troops from Nigeria, Chad, and Niger apparently fled when the attack took place and essentially abandoned the civilian citizens of this town to this incredibly murderous group, Boko Haram?
Well, I think it's good that we examine the background, you know, to at least to today. The first is that the area already has been under siege by Boko Haram, number one. Number two is the issue of morale within the Nigerian military. And number three, there are issues of politics, namely the three states where Boko Haram is currently operating. The leadership of those three states are under the auspices of APC, the major opposition to the current ruling party. And so you have politics, you have the morale within the military, and then you have the issue of trust. I will address those issues one by one. You have the issue of trust, namely some people not really trusting the military, and the military not really trusting the commanders, namely Abuja government and the top commanders, in the sense that they don't feel the support and they don't feel that they're equipped enough to address the issues generated by Boko Haram. So when you add all that up, it seems to give Boko Haram an upper hand, in the sense that they seem to be better organized. They have a higher morale, which means once they get one village and nobody is pushing them back with aggression, they take another and take another. It's like it's boosting their morale. And conversely, the military, on the other hand, losing morale, you know, weakening morale over and over. And I think what led to this is that I don't know if you recall, a few days ago, an adjacent village was raided and 40 young men were captured by by Boko Haram. And so to have them now launch an attack on a military base that is supposedly multi-task force, composing of troops from Nigeria, Chad, and Niger, and then taking over, that's really, really a big blow on the military. Even though the military has tried to deny each time Boko Haram seizes its weapons, namely the military weapons, they try to play down the magnitude of it. And so something is amiss here, and many Nigerians are wondering what is really going on.
Well, this is a multinational base on the border that has been set up to monitor criminal activity on Lake Chad. But it was almost entirely manned by Nigerian troops who fled. And the part that I don't understand, Anidi Okure, is that 10,000 Nigerians have been killed by Boko Haram this year alone, or this last year, 2014 alone. So what does it take to get the attention of the government of Goodluck Jonathan?
That's an excellent question, because there seem to be a nonchalant attitude on the part of the federal government towards Boko Haram. Let's go back to the abducted girls at Chibok. You know, these girls were abducted. 3 weeks later, the government did nothing. You know, we didn't see anything happening until people outside the country and a group of women within the country started making noise, you know, protesting. We organized a protest here in Washington. People gathered in London and across Nigeria. And our first lady, Michelle Obama, were posting a hashtag. It was then that the government in Nigeria responded to what it should have done 3 weeks earlier. So that kind of attitude makes people wonder what is really going on. Is the federal government really concerned about what is going on, or is it playing politics? And to some people, when they see that, touching what I mentioned earlier, that those three states are strongly APC, the opposition party, others feel that the non-responsive, apparently non-responsive or aggressive response on the part of the federal government is linked to that, that the advisors around the government, around the president, either not giving him the full picture or giving him wrong political advice. Either way, it is not settling well with Nigerians.
Well, it's very hard to understand. Again, I'm speaking with Anidi Okure, the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, who is a member of the Order of Preachers of the Dominican Province of St. Joseph the Worker in Nigeria and has served in various pastoral capacities in Nigeria, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the United States. What I find hard to understand, Anidi Okure, is that Nigeria has been run by military governments for some time up until this recent interregnum with more democratic but just as corrupt governments, it appears. Obviously, the leaders were lining their own pockets largely, but still, you know, with a military government, the military tends to get, you know, the cream off the top. So why is it that there's such a lack of morale and motivation with the Nigerian military?
Yeah, there is talk within the military and some of the people around the military that with the advent of the civilian regime, that the civilian government was, quote, gradually weakening the military to ensure that, quote, it doesn't stage another coup. I don't know how true that is, but that has been the news that is floating around. And secondly, is that what is happening here, that the government, the federal government has not been aggressive enough in equipping the military to deal with Boko Haram. Here's the situation. What you have just indicated, in the past decades, the Nigerian military has had an excellent reputation across the continent. They have put down, you know, uprising in other countries that have led AU, OAU/AU, peacekeeping force. They are the biggest shareholder and key players in ECOWAS, that is the Economic Community of West African Countries. And so that reputation is there. And that's the question many Nigerians continue to ask. What happened to this formidable military? What happened to these people who have succeeded in putting down uprising in other countries, even when those militants were far, far more superior and larger in number than Boko Haram? What's going on? And that's really the puzzle here. How do we explain that the Nigerian military is incapable of containing what started up as a ragtag group of people who have now grown into a formidable force against the military? Let me go back to the issue of morale within the military. As you are aware, this is not the first time the military have abandoned their base and run, or even refused to take action. Currently, there have been 54 soldiers, quote, sentenced to death for refusing to engage in Boko Haram, and now they are being charged with mutiny. And of course, some people are now have taken the case to the UN. But the point is that the military here is that those soldiers go and they fight with inferior weapons, they get killed. 3 months after they are dead, the military stops paying anything to the family, while the politicians live fat in excessive salaries. So there are a number of things that discourage the military in engaging and giving their life for people who don't seem to appreciate them. And then on the other hand, coming back to the issue of trust, you know, this same area is the area that in 2013, after the military were ambushed and killed, the offensive from the military was so brutal that they said, you know, the military had killed a couple of hundred people in the process of trying to react to the attacks on their men. And then there is they trust them on the side of the people, not trusting the military. The military not trusting the people. The military not trusting the federal government. And so the morale goes down and down and down.
Well, but is there a problem with international attention to Nigeria? You mentioned that the government of Goodluck Jonathan basically did nothing about the kidnapping of all the 200 schoolgirls until the rest of the world expressed outrage, including First Lady Michelle Obama. As far as I can tell, there's virtually no difference between Boko Haram and the Islamic State, the so-called Islamic State, in Iraq and Syria. They're just as – they're identical. They're murderous rapists and thugs and killers hiding behind some kind of religious ideology that they clearly have no claim to. So why do we not why do we spend so much time being alarmed about the so-called Islamic State and not Boko Haram?
Well, that's another area that is very sensitive, at least from my standpoint, as one who is advocating for justice and human rights and human dignity. There is a little, there's something that worries me here. Namely, it's true that the Nigerian military has engaged in human rights violation. You know, they state that up front. We can't deny that. But I don't see the same, you know, when those of us who are engaged in upholding human rights, I don't see us having the same outrage condemning the human rights violations by Boko Haram. In other words, we seem to seem to come down very hard on the Nigerian military and absolutely say almost nothing about the Boko Haram, who have engaged in far worse human rights violations over the years. And secondly, the international community, you know, it's under, I'm hearing now that when the Nigerian military asks for assistance, Britain, for example, have said, oh, we are weary about giving latest weapons to Nigeria military because they are engaged in human rights violations. The U.S. says the same thing. And yet, as you say, you know, we are forming alliances with people we know in the Middle East are engaged in far serious human rights violations. We are forming alliances with them to fight the ISIS.
Sure.
So, there is something here that I can't really explain. I seem to be a double standard.
Absolutely. And I thank you so much for joining us. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Anidi Okoro, but thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Anidi Okoro, who is the Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.